Well, I'm going to say that's great, CEO, but if you'd like to have an effective year, I think it's worth taking your hat in your hand and going to talk to Mary down there, because John has listened to Mary ever since he came to this company, because Mary was his first assistant. And usually any intelligent boss will say, gotcha. Mary and I are having a lunch on Wednesday. Something else wonderful happens when you can get your executives to do that. The whole company wants to be in on success, because now they're part of it, and you, as a counselor, have brought these kind of changes to bear. How about thinking about and really understanding, though, the motivations of these people? How about that? There are essentially five human motivations. If you want a real technical list of what motivates humans, you want to get a hold of the work of Harold Laswell. Laswell has, I think, well, the last I knew anyway, Jim, for all time, classified 8 modes of motivation. I want to give you 5 quickies that are strictly my own, because I find in organizations and out in the world, these external publics that we're working with, people fall in 5 categories. There are a number of people whose real goal in the world is just to get by. So when I go to consult with them, I want to say, look, you know, if you work with us on this, it'll leave you basically untouched. Nothing will change. Great, I'm with you. We'll go for this right now. Just leave me alone. There are another bunch whose real goal is enjoying life. So I have to show them it's either fun or it isn't going to disrupt their enjoyment or whatever. Then there are those more dangerous types, the ones whose real goal is getting ahead. The union leader who's trying to organize you, for whom organizing is very secondary. What he really wants is to be president of the international union, okay? And so if you deal with him as an organizational issue, merely trying to organize your company, you're dead. That's not what he's after at all. He wants to get to be the international president, so maybe you can cut a deal and get him some publicity instead. I don't know. But then there are those people, even more dangerous, often, not always, who want to become somebody. They don't just want to get ahead. They want to be stars in the firmament. Obviously, we have to deal with them totally differently. And by the way, this list, of course, as you'll quickly recognize, applies to the people that you're counseling at all levels of your organization, because these are the motivations that they're going to work with. And then there's a very small, not entirely trusted group whose real goal in life is to help others. Not many of them, a lot of poseurs in that class. And I don't care what method you use, you hear what I'm saying too. If you're going to be a counselor, you got to have an understanding of who's out there and what's going to push their button. Now, it also helps if you have an understanding of the style of your counselee, particularly their conflict management style. If you're not familiar with the classic document in conflict management, which is a test you can administer, it's the Thomas Kilman conflict grid. Look it up, Thomas-Kilman. They have a wonderful document that you as a counselor can use on your managers. Sit them around the table, because remember, conflict management today is probably the single most important managerial skill. Getting people to let their ideas conflict without letting them as humans conflict. So we can really use the bouncing of ideas off one another to get creativity and new directions and still all go out happily and get a beer together afterwards. That's what management is quickly becoming. Well, the Thomas Kilman grid tells us that there are 5 styles, and this includes not just dealing with people, it includes dealing with issues. First of all, there are the avoiders. Incidentally, I guess I should say right here, maybe you ought to go home. Maybe all of us ought to go home and take the Thomas Kilman test ourselves. Because as you'll see, while this applies to our counselees and maybe other people we're having to look at, where we fall on this scale is going to quickly tell us whether we have any future in counseling. There are avoiders. There are accommodators. Hey, let's just cut a deal. My motivation is just to get by here and survive. I'm not going to do anything that changes. Then there are compromisers. They even go beyond that. Let's compromise here. Then there are Competers? Oh, no, you don't. We're going to fight it out at the OK Corral. Don't get far with them. And then there are collaborators, people who really want to say, hey, come on, let's talk about this and see if we can't have a win-win situation. Haven't got time to go into this a lot. I'm merely suggesting to you that effective counselors, very early on, through observation or a document like a test, find out the style of the people they're going to consult. Because if you're dealing with a competitor, a person who sees everything as competition, you can see where you are. They're not probably interested in solving the problem. They're interested in winning. And in modern American organizations and life, you know what the chances of that are. You may win today, but you'll probably lose tomorrow. Here's a neat little counseling technique. If you're having trouble with a counselee, ask them to draw a picture of the organization as they see it, as an animal, or as an automobile. Or say, you know, if this organization were a 24-year-old woman, what would she be wearing? Or if this were a 60-year-old man, you know, how would he be dressed? This is a kind of a fun little thing. You shove the paper and say, come on, loosen up. I mean, draw the picture. They will tell you more in that picture. And furthermore, they will have to think about the structure into which they're working. This also works wonderfully with groups at all levels of the company, but it's a great counseling technique. And you know, we get these automobiles that have no headlights or no steering wheel, or they're all tailpipe, you know. Or there's the motor and here's the wheels and there's no drive shaft. They are telling you more in that little picture than in probably 6 months of psychoanalysis, and that's what counselors need. We also need to remember that managers, according to all the best information we have, the people we're counseling always believe that the publics we're working with know a lot more than those publics actually know. You're probably familiar with the TARP, Technical Assistance Research Project tests. They started out being sponsored by Coke. They ended up with a whole range of big name sponsors. They found that on a scale of 1 to 100, when you ask the managers, how much do you think your key publics know about your product or company or policy or whatever the subject is, they on the average were at about 85. They thought the public really knew 85. When you went out and asked the public, they knew 15. See why the confrontation stage, the confronting stage, starts counseling. We have to build reality in, or else we're working in an environment that is unreal. A counselor forced to work in an environment that is not accurate, is unreal, is filled with misperceptions, is treading on extremely dangerous turf. If they won't buy that idea, just do a little simple piece of research. It's one of the brilliant pieces of research, I think. Whoever dreamed it up deserves a lot of credit. We call it a stands for, known for test. We get our client, maybe our whole client management, maybe a department, maybe an individual, to write down or give us some documents that they say describes, this is what we stand for here in the shipping department at Jones Hospital, okay? Then we go out and ask the customers of the shipping department, what are they known for? Well, you know, stand for always is on-time delivery, no breakage in the shipping. Known for usually is always late, everything is damaged. Well, you gotta get the reality into it. And I have never found a technique that is simply and quickly gets our clients to face the reality. If that isn't working for you, there are a couple of other tools that may. Have your client go through a customer satisfaction model, whether these are internal customers or external customers. And I'm assuming that all of you are into the customer mode. The CEO ain't the boss today. The CEO has a group of next level managers that are his or her customers, and on down it works. And I know you're all laughing saying, not in my outfit, but that's got to be the goal, because it's the ultimate result of the application of the public relations philosophy. Every individual participating. Well, do a customer satisfaction model. They're very simple. Have a group sit down and draw a model of what they think a satisfied customer would be like. Don't let it be too airy-fairy. Make it realistic. What would a satisfied customer be thinking, saying, doing? over time or immediately after a transaction or upon receiving information or whatever. Make it very real. Take that model then out to the customers, and either through research or a focus group or getting the customer and the management together, rebuild the model from the customer's viewpoint. And then turn to the management and say, okay, that's what a satisfied customer is. Now design your activities to satisfy that customer. It's a form of knowns for, stands for, but it has all kinds of fascinating fallout. And notice what you are doing. You are facilitating your client in facing the major decisions of their success. And you're doing it. You're the facilitator. That's counseling. When it's all done, the boss, according to all the rules of counseling, will say, boy, I really did a good job on this. Who? PR person? What PR person? No, I did this. Wonderful. That's effective counseling. Now, when it comes time for a raise, of course, please have good documentation. Another thing that good counselors do is they really do understand the third-party syndrome. They understand when you have to get somebody else to pick up the case. And I think many of us aren't good at that. I know in my own case, too often I don't get out of there quick enough and bring in someone else in the firm or call another firm or whatever, because there comes that point when they can't hear us anymore. And so, well, you know, look, you know I go around and do all this counseling. You know how us counselors work, those of you that aren't counselors? Well, we come into your organization, we have you tell us what ought to be done, we go tell the boss exactly that, and it gets done. I mean, it's just that simple. We have no genius or magic. It's just that they can hear us. We all know this principle. Do we apply it? If you got a really tough case, try this one. Put up pictures of all the people who are going to be involved in the decision. Put a picture right up on the wall. And you and your group sit around and look at these pictures and remember what you're trying to get them to do here, what you're counseling them to do. And then underneath it, list the likelihood. You know, when you're looking right into that ugly puss here of the CEO, you see, and you're saying, is this guy or gal likely to do these things? And then maybe after you've looked at the group that's on the decision-making board, you find that maybe there's a sort of two that you're pretty sure ain't going to buy in, and two that, hey, they're going to go, and there's maybe two that are swing votes. Well, I guess you know what your assignment is. Concentrate on seeing those two swing votes. Get them sold onto your position. See them first, one-on-one. The most effective of all counseling techniques is to be a trainer in your organization. If you aren't doing training, you are missing the great opportunity. And in fact, I would postulate that public relations in the next 5 to 7 years will become almost totally a strategizing and training function. Why? Because we're facing the realities of the world. All that great paper and video and that you and I send out of the ivory tower isn't cutting it anymore. People don't have time for it. So who builds the relationships? Well, the people who always did. The ones who laughed at what we send out of the ivory tower and went right ahead themselves and either built or didn't build the relationships, namely everybody in the organization. You and I can do great stuff, but we don't interface at the sales desk, on the loading dock, in the executive suites. So therefore, if we position ourselves now as the trainers, remember, we have that unique body of knowledge that we believe in. Well, if we really do, then we can train others in it. And when you do that, they start seeing you differently. You are ready to be a counselor. It is so easy. If you can't get started in any other way, then offering to hold a class Friday over a brown bag lunch on how to write shorter memos, do it. That subject, by the way, will probably fill the room. Particularly if you say the reason you ought to come to this class is not so you can write shorter memos, but so all those other turkeys will write you shorter memos. You're sure to have a rather full house. Training is also now becoming very much a substantive item on public relations topics. The key items that people want training in, according to the American Society of Training Development, are these. These are the top 10 in the next 5 years. Customer service, that sound like our territory? New market strategies, organizational mission, sound like our turf? Corporate culture, our turf. Productivity improvement. We have a big role in productivity improvement because productivity, though managers continue to believe that productivity is improved by new machines and better engineering methods, anybody who's ever been in an organization knows that the greatest new machine and method can be shot down in 2 seconds flat by a recalcitrant workforce. Productivity comes from people who want to be productive. So that's a relationship and a communication area, something we can teach on. Quality improvement. Well, sadly, we sort of let that one get away. I don't know if you know anything about the quality movement. It's based on better communication. How the hell did some other group pop up and claim they own this territory? You know why? Because we weren't counseling. That's why I think it's so critical that we really look at ourselves on this subject and get on the ball so others aren't doing it for us. Well, we could talk about a lot of other stuff. For those of you that work in organizations, I might just say that counseling really means managing up. Wherever you are in the organization, you have to manage upward. And I would suggest to you that every public relations practitioner is and has to be a counselor. I don't care if you're a new hire just out of school. If you just salute and do what you're told every time without saying, could I explain to you some things that we know now that might make this better? If you don't at least do that, you're going to get into the mold of being a technician. And the toughest thing is to break out of the mold. Have you ever talked to a young lawyer just out of law school? Have you ever? If you haven't had that pleasure, I use that word dubiously, if you haven't had that word pleasure, that pleasure, go do it. They are so cocksure, and they are going to offer counsel from the beginning. We need to start that way. When we hire people, we need to train our new hires in counseling techniques so they too can represent our department, our firm, simply, very tactfully saying, well, gosh, that sounds like a great idea, Mr. Client, but what if? Are we prepared for the what if? What can we do to help you prepare for the what if? By the way, I take it goes without saying that bosses, therefore, should never be thought of as bosses, only as clients. Our bosses are our clients, our fellow managers are our clients, and increasingly, every person in that organization is our clients. Lawyers are very clear about that. So are most of the other professions. Well, there's an ultimate question that goes underneath all of this, and that is, are we risk averse? Are our organizations risk averse? Let's assume they are, or we are. How do you become a counselor when you're scared to death in this economy about getting on the wrong side of people that can have some effects on your life? Well, one thing that we're finding, and you may want to try, is this. Basic psychology and relationships tell us that if you're willing to surface an issue and lay it right on the table and talk about it openly, that's how you get things done. So if you've got a risk-averse organization, or if you are risk-averse, how about just meeting with your client or your boss and discussing what is acceptable risk? Have you ever done that? You know, you're always saying, you know, writing all these wonderful documents, our people will take risk. Let's us have a deal on what is acceptable risk. When can I go out there, and when do I have to come back and check with you? See if you can write a risk statement, a contract of risk between you and your client or you and your boss. That, I would suggest to you, is in itself counseling. You are helping your client or your boss understand that all these wonderful words they're using, take chances, be creative, don't mean a thing if their behavior is otherwise. And by getting it into a risk statement, you'll find, as in most contract psychology, that you've got a lot better shot at really getting some things done. I want to just make a couple of suggestions to you, because I know some of you are maybe dubious about this. I am truly convinced, I've been in this field a long time, and I get through my work, my various kinds of work, through PRSA and the other organizations, through the newsletters that I do, the speeches and sessions that I give, and our own counseling across the United States and Canada. I get to talk to lots of you every day, every week. I truly believe that the future of public relations is more in the area of our being able to counsel than it is in any other area. Oh, we're terrible strategists. The excellent studies that the Grunigs and a group of others are doing for the IABC Foundation make it crystal clear that we're not meeting the needs. But maybe we're not meeting the needs because we don't know how to present the needs. We haven't understood this process. So to me, the future of this field is in our being able to step up there alongside the lawyers, the engineers, the accountants, and the other professionals as true counselors to senior management. I don't know if you read PR Reporter. I hope you do. We had an item in there recently from Harold Burson. Harold has this awful story that he tells of being called to a client. CEO calls up and says, Harold, get right out here. I got a problem. I need you. So he gets on a plane in the middle of the night the way we all do, and he flies out, and the boss says, the reason I asked you to come is because Joe, our longtime head of PR, is retiring or being fired or whatever, and I need you to help me find a successor. And so Harold says, well, aren't we lucky that Charlie, the good old number two, has been here for 10 years and is ready to move into that slot. He knows the company. And the boss interrupts him, says Harold, and says, no, wait a minute, you don't understand. He says, that's what I've never liked about our PR here, is that it's not helping me, it's not being done right. And he says, think about Charlie. He says, I want someone who can sit at the senior management table, someone who will call all of us managers to account and say, wait a minute, you've forgotten the human element in this. You've forgotten relationships. Your strategy isn't right. You've forgotten who you need to give your behaviors. He says, you've known Charlie a long time, Harold. Can you see Charlie sitting with our executive committee? You know what Harold says? 99 times out of 100, he has to say, no, I'll help you find somebody for the job. I think that is nothing short of a tragedy. And I think you and I can do a lot to stop that from happening. But I think it's going to begin with our ability to stand up there and really counsel our clients. By the way, if you want to do this job, there are three books you got to have. One is The Body of Knowledge. The other is you got to know all about negotiating, because counseling is negotiating. Quickest way to know the five steps of negotiating is to read Getting to Yes. Why read anything else? It's a short book. It tells it all. It'll all sound so familiar to you if you haven't read it. It's PR 101, but you got to have that book. The authors are two authors, Roger Fisher and Bill Ury, U-R-Y. They come out of the Harvard Negotiation Project, and I know it's tough to trust anything out of a couple of Harvard academics, but this is okay. The other book is Flawless Consulting, the classic book by Peter Block. It's written essentially for OD counselors, but in this book is all the wisdom you will ever need about positioning yourself as a counselor. If you know your field, if you read that, you'll be in fairly good shape, I think, to get out there and do the job that needs to be done. And remember, if in doubt, if you're a little fearful about this, how do I take those first steps? Just remember what the first female admiral in the Navy said when asked how she got to be an admiral when no other women did. And she says, I have a very simple rule, you'll remember this. It's easier to beg forgiveness than to ask permission. Don't wait to be asked. Get out there and counsel those suckers, because they're screwing it up, and we've got to help them. Thanks for listening. You know, we have got a couple of minutes for questions. It's not like me to allow you to ask questions, but there is time. Dick? Yeah. Richard Evans is making a good point about options. He's pointing out that I to do it this way, I sort of paint it as if it's a black and white, here are the options. And he's pointing out that actually if you're collaboratively counseling, you sort of work through the options as you go. So you aren't left at the end with here's my all-time list of three options. But in fact, you have worked through these as a process, and so you are, again, being a collaborative consultant, even though you all end up with maybe a single option having discarded the others. Very good advice.
How do you view the element of age in counseling someone younger?
Well, we're here to talk about diversity, aren't we? You know, this is an interesting question. To answer it, I have to tell you something about our firm. There are 25 counselors in our firm, four of which are male. I had to face this a long time ago. The male-female differentiation, the age differentiation, the personality differentiations are critical. That's where the third party comes in. Get somebody else in your department who does it better. Networking is a reality. Who gets along with who sees the world the same. I find that if you just are forced to bluster ahead, you will, to a large extent, be pushing upstream, and it just simply may not work. Make sure there is that fit. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just have to do it, knowing that you're up against that barrier. But certainly I should have listed that as one of the great barriers if we don't heads up deal with it. Any other? Yes, Ted. That's a good question. If you're the counselor and you've got some programs suggested and adopted, do you then immediately switch hats and become the tactical technicians who carry them out? Unfortunately, today, with smaller departments, you may have to do that. There are some little tricks that I find people are using, and that is that, as in any good organization, you make it clear that staff and others are doing the carrying out. In other words, you have folks who do this. You are the counselor. What do you do if you're a one-person organization? I guess you bite the bullet, put on your hat as a tactician, and go carry it out. The problem is, not therefore to go back to that client to check technical questions. You see, you can't both counsel the client on strategy and then run back to check tactical questions, because then it's very hard for them to see you as a strategist. I mean, what are you here, you see? And I understand if you're in a very small organization, there's the boss and you, obviously the rules are out the window. You have to find a way. Now, how do you overcome that if you're in that position? Keep circulating to your management, keep bringing up to your management while you're in the middle of tactics, other situations, getting entry on other topics, giving them the kind of counseling information that they need, like issue anticipation. You know, hey, I see this coming along, or as this project that I'm now carrying out tactically moves toward a conclusion, I think the next step is going to be this. In other words, constantly through those necessary steps anyway, reminding them that you basically are a counselor and you're only acting as a tactician because maybe you're all there is. Those are at least some of the things that I see people doing. Incidentally, you know, our theme here is what's right at this conference. And I guess I should have been sure to toss in the fact that you as a counselor will be faced with the question of which comes first, you know, the organization or the professional tenets and norms that you represent. This is the ethical question of counseling. And I trust after these days together that we know that we have to stand tall for the ethical norms. This doesn't mean you have to quit and leave. In fact, I find people who get into ethical situations who quit and leave are doing exactly the wrong thing. I think that's unethical. The ethical thing is to stick around as long as you can and try and change the behavior. And when you're absolutely certain you got an ironclad case, you couldn't change the behavior, maybe then it's time to go somewhere else. But this screaming of, oh, not me, the first time a situation comes up where you might be asked to do something you consider unethical, is a little bit holier than thou, I believe. So I think, nonetheless, there is an ethical side to counseling. And you'll be in it very soon if you look. You've all been in it. I don't have to preach to you. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Oh, ASTD, American Society of Training and Development. It's still in New York. That's right. I think they moved to suburban Washington. Look them up in Gale's directory or any classic directory. It is for the training side of human resources and OD what PRSA is. You know, if you're not taking part in ASTD stuff, get on their mailing list anyway for your local chapter. We really, if the truth be known, we ought to be taking those people over. You know, I'm very serious. You ought to own the trainers in your outfit, because if you don't watch out, they and their HR bosses are going to own us. And what they're doing, or ought to be doing, is what we do. Every time they train, they should, in addition to subject matter, be building teamwork, building pride, building morale, building relationships, and frankly, very, very few of them see it that way. It's a great opportunity. Yes? Closing the sale. The toughest question of all. Closing the sale for me usually means saying, okay, we've looked at the data, you've seen the details, are we ready to go with this? Just as simple as that. Are we ready to go with this? And the answer is usually one of two, yes or no. Now, unfortunately, there you can't say, do you want to do this once or twice? That probably probably won't work. They'll say, do it right the first time, jerk. But I just use a simple technique like that. You know, we beat this thing to death. Are we ready? Do we need another meeting? That's another one. Do we need another meeting on this, or shall we get with it? And I find putting it in those kind of terms kind of a flighty, you know, hey, let's go here. None of this formal, are you going to write an official order on this, sir, or that kind of baloney, because he'll never get around to it, or she. That's what I do. Have we talked about this enough? Have we got enough data? And if they say no, then fine, who should we get in? See, always that positive, of course we're going to do this because it makes such sense. That's the attitude, of course we're going to do this. And are we ready to start now, or do we need to look at it some more? The fine line between selling and counseling, and the fine line is that if we sell our ideas too hard as opposed to selling our technique and our body of knowledge too hard, then we become expert consultants. The difficulty, I guess, or the balance is, how do you sell our professional skills, our technology, our strategy, without slipping over into selling the specific ideas that may arise from them? So our job is to sell the strategies, the body of knowledge, and help them apply it to the situation and make the specific decisions that have to be made at the moment. Yes? Oh-dee-do-dee-do. Let me, give me your card and I'll send you their address. I think they're in California. All these OD gurus, of course, are in California. It's a great system, though. Thomas Kilman they're one of these outfits that have, you know, several million uses of their document in their computer, so it's a little hard to argue that it's at least fairly accurate business parlor psychology, anyway. Does a pretty good job. You know, there's a lot of subtlety in all this. And I don't think we need to shy away, as tough as we're selling and all that, we need to shy away from subtlety. The best example of subtlety I know is, if you know anything about Scotland, the Scots are still a little ripped off that the English took them over in the early 1600s. And despite the best efforts of the old-timers to keep the Scots tongue alive, why anybody would want to, I don't know, if you've ever heard it spoken. But in any event, despite their best efforts to keep the Scots tongue alive, English really has taken over Scotland. So a couple of years ago, for the first time since the early 17th century, the Church of Scotland retranslated its Bible. The whole Bible. And this was fought out on the floor of the Scottish legislature. The whole Bible is in English. And it just made the old believers in Scots mad. So you know what they did? They made a slight change. The whole Bible is now in English, except when the Lord speaks, he speaks Scots.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate that, Robert.
Yeah.